So the title I gave David way back when was, as he just said, The Condensed Matter Physics of QCD. One of the main purposes of that title was to tell all the people whom I see in this room from the QCD program that this is not a talk intended for them. So you guys can all leave now. I'm going to try and give a talk on... I'm going to try and give a talk intended for everyone else in the room. So as you all know, if you ask what is QCD, well, it's a theory of quarks and gluons. If you look in the Lagrangian, you see a Lagrangian with quarks and gluons in it. But if you ask what does QCD describe, it describes hadrons. Sort of the things in this room which are described by QCD are the hadrons, the protons and the neutrons. And for the condensed matter physicists in the room, the way of thinking about this is that the hadrons are the quasi-particles of the QCD vacuum. They are the natural excitations with which, the natural language with which to discuss the excitations of the vacuum. And they're very complicated. The ITP could organize a whole other program on the structure of hadrons. There's been a lot of experimental and theoretical work devoted to understanding these quasi-particles. But QCD as a theory is asymptotically free, which means that if you go to regimes where the quarks are close together or interacting at high momentum transfer, really, since very shortly after the discovery of QCD as an asymptotically free theory, this various people realized back in the mid-70s that this might imply that if you go to either high temperatures or high baryon densities. At high temperatures, the quarks are interacting at large momentum transfer, and at high baryon densities, the quarks are close together. So you either take a chunk of matter and heat it up, or you take a chunk of matter and squeeze it. In either case, you might expect, given that the theory is asymptotically free, maybe you get, well, new phases. And perhaps they might be simpler phases. They might be simpler because they might have quasi-particles which look more like what you see in the Lagrangian. You might get rid of all the complications of the QCD vacuum, which are there because the theory in the infrared is strong coupling, manifest confinement, chiral symmetry breaking, all those fun but difficult phenomena. If you can go to high temperatures or high densities, maybe we can get away from them. And this has been the motivation for a long time in studying the phases of QCD. And what I'm going to do in this talk is take you for a walk through the phase diagram, which I'm going to probably keep here on the board for the whole talk. The vertical axis here is temperature. And to set a scale, the natural units for temperature, well, I'm going to put a number here, 170 MeV on the vertical axis. Interesting things in QCD happen at temperatures of order a few hundred MeV. A few hundred MeV in condensed matter physics units is 10 to the 12th Kelvin, so it's quite hot. But this is a temperature on the natural scale of the theory, temperature of order the natural scale of the theory. The horizontal axis is going to be baryon density. And instead of density, I'm going to use a chemical potential. So this is the chemical potential for baryon number, sometimes written mu sub b, although I will usually forget the subscript. And roughly, what do we expect? Well, we expect down here at low temperatures and low baryon densities that QCD describes the gas of hadrons. Here's the vacuum. And if you don't turn on too large a chemical potential or too large a temperature, you should certainly expect a description based on the quasi-particles of the vacuum, which are the hadrons, as I said before. But we expect some kind of a line which at least topologically looks like this. I'm going to draw it actually. We'll be talking a lot about the physics associated with this line. We expect some sort of a line outside of which different things happen. And this naive hope that physics becomes simpler is actually realized, we now think, if you go up. So if you go up in temperature, you get to a new phase of the theory conventionally called the quark gluon plasma. And as is familiar in condensed matter physics, or well, as in any context in physics, going up in temperature means entropy wins. So whatever the ordering there was that complicated life down here is lost as you go up in temperature. But one of the things that has been realized is that as you go out in density, it's not as simple as losing the order of the vacuum. And this is a lesson which should have been obvious to any condensed matter physicist. We know from condensed matter physics that the fundamental condensed matter physics at some fundamental level, at some overly reductionist level, is a gauge theory with a coupling of 1 over 137, which is very small. There's no way we're ever going to push QCD to high enough densities or temperatures to reduce the QCD coupling to anywhere near that small. Yes?
It's true, as you go up in temperature, you're used to thinking about entropy winning. But, yeah. But as soon as you say entropy, you imply equilibrium.
Yeah. So this is going to be an equilibrium talk. We'll. I mean, at various.
Absolutely, whether the system is equilibrium.
Yeah, we're going to come to that. Yes, absolutely. We're going to come to that. Let me come to that in half a second, and then again in about half an hour. But this is the equilibrium phase diagram of QCD. Period. And at high densities. Well, the lesson from condensed matter physics is that even in equilibrium, there's all kinds of different phenomena. At some overly reductionist level, the coupling is 1 over 137, but yet we have solids, liquids, gases, ferromagnets, antiferromagnets, superconductors, superfluids, all kinds of different patterns of order possible. And so, in fact, what we now expect in QCD is that out here at high densities but not too large temperatures, there are new forms of order. In particular, there are phases. We're going to dissect this region of the diagram further later on, but there are phases which collectively are called color superconductors. And the idea here is simply, well, you're at high densities, but you're not at large temperatures. So instead of just assuming that the order of the vacuum melts away, there may be new possible forms of order, and this will be the subject of the first half of this talk. So how does nature or experimentalists explore this diagram? Well, nature does so in two ways. The Big Bang started out hot and cooled essentially down the vertical axis here. Mu in the Big Bang was some number of order 10 to the minus 9. Mu you can think of as controlling the baryon number to entropy ratio. And the entropy of the hot Big Bang was very large relative to its baryon number. So for all practical purposes in this talk, cosmology lives on the vertical axis. And if you ask, when did the universe go through this characteristic QCD scale temperature, the answer is when it was about 10 microseconds old. So the universe was made of quark gluon plasma for its first 10 microseconds, and ever since then, it's been a gas of hadrons. Now, out here on the horizontal axis, first of all, I have to add nuclei. Nuclei, or nuclear matter, have some non-zero baryon density. And they have some non-zero baryon chemical potential. The baryon chemical potential in nuclear matter is roughly the mass of a baryon. It's the mass of a baryon minus the binding energy. So you can think of this as of order, mu baryon is of order 900 MeV. It's 900 and something MeV anyway. Now I want to, for many purposes, it's actually convenient to refer to mu. The chemical potential for quark number instead of for baryon number. So in terms of if this is mu b of 900, then it's mu q of 300. So just for reference, remember that the quark chemical potential in nuclear matter is roughly 300 MeV. Now, the only way we know of taking matter and squeezing it without heating it is to build a neutron star. So we don't actually know where the centers of neutron stars lie on this diagram, but we know that on these scales, it's at zero temperature. And it's at some density larger than that of nuclei. So neutron stars live along here somewhere. The centers of neutron stars are somewhere along this line. Now, so that's nature. What about experimentalists? What experimentalists do is they build accelerators which take two of these and slam them together. And now we come to Fred's question. When you do a heavy ion collision, it's crucial to ask about equilibration. It's not obvious a priori that heavy ion collisions belong on this phase diagram. They may be entirely non-equilibrium processes. But if they do, then the idea is that you collide two of these, you have some non-equilibrium, of course the initial state is highly non-equilibrium. Everybody's going either this way or this way. If there's enough rescattering to lead to thermalization, the whole goal of heavy ion collisions is to create some approximately equilibrated stuff which lives up here on the phase diagram, or maybe lives up here on the phase diagram. But of course, when you do one of these heavy ion collisions, and if equilibration occurs and you're very happy we're up here, you don't stay up here for very long, because there's no walls. You've just done a collision. You've made this hot stuff. There's no walls holding it in. So you should think of heavy ion collisions as following downward trajectories on this diagram. And so to tell you where I'm going in this talk, I'm going to begin at high mu and small temperature and talk about this physics. And here my goal really is to, at a qualitative level, describe what the new patterns of order we think are occurring out here are and what they might be telling us that's of interest to an astrophysicist. Then I'll change gears and talk about hot quark matter. And here I'm actually going to, there's a lot that's been done theoretically, but the interesting new developments in the last couple of years here are the experiments. So when I get to here, I'm not going to focus on theory. I'm going to focus on experiments. Okay, so first of all, why we actually know a lot more from the theoretical point of view about the vertical axis than the horizontal axis. And the reason for that is that on the vertical axis, we have ab initio calculations using the methods of lattice gauge theory. Basically, take the theory and solve the path integral numerically. That works along this axis. It does not work along this axis. So there are no lattice calculations on the horizontal axis. Now, why is that? I just want to advertise this as an outstanding problem. The problem is that as soon as you take a chemical potential which is not zero, then the Euclidean action becomes complex. This is a manifestation of the fermion sign problem, which is familiar in many condensed matter physics contexts. This is just a way of saying that when you have a bunch of fermions around, there's a problem, because in the path integral, if two of them switch, you get a minus sign. That in this Euclidean formalism, which is the one used to do lattice gauge theory, that manifests itself as the Euclidean action becoming complex. And the way lattice gauge theorists do path integrals is that they use the Euclidean action as a probability measure. And now you have a complex probability measure, so you're screwed. And roughly speaking, when this happens, the difficulty of doing a calculation using standard Monte Carlo methods goes like e to the volume of the lattice. The difficulty grows exponentially with volume, and that's hard. So this is, if someone solves the fermion sign problem and thus is able to simulate the Hubbard model ab initio, that same person should try their hand at this problem too. And similarly, if anyone in the QCD world, in the lattice QCD world, figures out a fundamental solution to the sign problem in this context, then they can also make some profit by trying whatever their method is on the Hubbard model. Okay. And in fact, Uwe Wiese is one of my colleagues who is attempting this, but he hasn't yet succeeded. If he had, you would know about it. Okay, but evasions are possible. So no one has solved this problem, but people have tried to evade it. And the evasions fall into two classes. One class, you try, if I put a number here, you try and make this number as small as possible. And you can see that's a pretty feeble evasion, but this goes under the name reweighting. And if you do that, then maybe you can do a simulation in a small box, but obviously you can't go to large boxes. The other kind of evasion, which has been popular very recently, is to work at imaginary mu and then continue results, observables, to real mu. And it turns out, not obviously so, but work just in the last couple of months shows that this is actually useful. It's not obvious that this would be useful, but this is useful if mu over t is less than something which turns out to be pi over 3, so you can think of that as 1. So long as you are at, and this is mu quark. So long as you're to the left of a diagonal line, which is actually roughly about here, and it includes all of the region of interest to heavy ion people, there has been very recent developments on the lattice which hold great promise for, they're not solving a fundamental problem, but they're practical. They're likely of practical value. I'll come back to this when we talk about hot quark matter. But pi over 3 comes from the fact that if you, in imaginary mu, if you go beyond this, you run into a Z3 transition, which has no analog in real mu. So you run into a pathology of imaginary mu, which precludes analytic continuation.
So this is for QCD.
This is for QCD. It may break down earlier than this, but it has to break down here, is the right way of saying it. I have to think about that. We can figure that out.
So you're saying there are transitions both for imaginary mu and for real mu.
There's the actual transition that you're interested in, but in imaginary mu there's another thing which is a fake. And I'll talk a little more about this when I get to the hot stuff. Okay, so I want to start here with cold quark matter, and given this pessimistic introduction, how can you learn anything? Obviously, you can't learn anything about cold quark matter from ab initio calculations, and what people have therefore been doing is to follow one of two strategies. One strategy is to, if you like, start by extending this axis way, 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 way out to here, and when mu is very large, then the coupling is weak. You can use asymptotic freedom and do a calculation that you trust, and then try and take a result that you trust over there and apply it here. That's one strategy. The other strategy is to take a model of the hadrons. So take a model that you've sort of, whose parameters you've tuned over the decades, and you believe that it does a reasonable qualitative description of describing some hadron physics. Take some model that in some sense works here and apply it there. And both those strategies have been followed with considerable profit. But what's the phenomenon? So what might we be trying to describe with either one of those strategies? The idea is very simple. If you want to describe quark matter somewhere out here, how do you start? Well, I have fermions filling Fermi surfaces out to some large Fermi energy. If I'm out here, the Fermi energy is large compared to all other scales in the problem. Mu here, by the way, mu quark. So if I neglect masses, mu quark is the Fermi energy. So if I take mu quark out here somewhere, I have a large Fermi surface. And we then know that the right question to ask is there any attraction? Because if there's attraction, you get pairing. So if there's an attraction between the quarks, that will lead to pairing and the formation of a condensate of diquarks. Instead of the dielectron condensate of Cooper pairs, these are Cooper pairs of quarks. Now, if you follow this first principles logic in metals, you would, of course, give up right now, because you'd say, well, electrons repel each other. And if you didn't have experiments to guide you, you wouldn't think that there was an attraction, or unless you were very smart. In QCD, you don't actually have to be smart, because there's a very strong attraction. In QCD, two quarks attract each other if they're antisymmetric in color. The fundamental Coulomb interaction, which is repulsive between electrons, it's also repulsive between quarks of the same color, but quarks attract each other if they're antisymmetric in color. This obviously is not possible with electrons. All electrons have the same charge. You can't antisymmetrize an electric charge. But if I have a red quark and a green quark, and if I make a pair wave function, which is red-green minus green-red, then the QCD interaction is attractive. So this already suggests the fact that I'm getting attraction from the fundamental, let me just say strong attraction, the fact that I'm getting attraction from the fundamental interaction in the theory, which is strong, suggests that I'm going to get very robust superconductivity. And in particular, when people then go and estimate the gaps, So as a fiducial place to sort of make estimates, people have conventionally discussed what happens at mu of either four. Some people have used 400, some 500. There's no meaning in the difference. And mu of this is mu quark. Mu quark of 400 to 500 MeV is somewhere out here. Corresponds in density to 5 to 10 times nuclear matter density. It's the kind of density that is of interest to thinking about the centers of neutron stars. And if you go and take this mu and either stick it into a formula which you derived way out here, or stick it into a model estimate and ask what kind of gaps you get, the kinds of gaps that you get are of order 100 MeV. I think the record for the largest gap is that in a calculation by Greg Carter. Greg must be in the room. Is Greg in the room? I saw Greg earlier today. He's not in the room. Anyway, Greg and Mitya Dyakonov did a calculation of the flavor that I described as starting with here. Their model of the vacuum is called the instanton liquid. They took an instanton liquid model, applied it out here, and got a gap of 200 MeV. That's the biggest estimate that I know. There are a variety of estimates ranging from sort of 20 to 200 MeV for the gap, just to set the scale. And you can see, by the way, that this is gap over Fermi energy of order of a quarter or a fifth. So it's a very strong coupling BCS superconductor. OK. Now, I don't want to show you how to do these calculations. What I want to do instead is talk about the phenomena. So let's ask the obvious question, who pairs with whom? And to decide who pairs with whom, we have to decide how many flavors we're talking about. So I'm going to start by talking about three-flavor quark matter, so ups, downs, and stranges. And I'm going to neglect, for the moment, masses. We'll come back to this. If you neglect masses, then life is simpler, so we'll start there. I want color antisymmetry, because that's where the attraction is. I want spin antisymmetry for, in other words, angular, and I want, in fact, I want L equals 0 and S equals 0. That gives you the largest condensation energy. You can think of it as allowing you to use the whole Fermi surface. By not breaking rotational invariance, you get to use the whole Fermi surface. And these two force me to have flavor antisymmetry. These two plus Pauli force me into flavor antisymmetry. Now, let's just think what spin antisymmetry means. I'm going to use left and right. I'm going to talk about left-handed quarks and right-handed quarks. Cooper pairing, I always pair a quark with momentum P and minus P. If I have a quark with momentum P and minus P, and if I'm spin antisymmetric, that means the spins have to be opposite. And if their momenta are opposite and their spins are opposite, then their helicities are the same. So spin antisymmetry means I have pairing of left-left and right-right pairing. So let me then try and make a Cooper pair, two left-handed quarks. I think this room is getting very warm. Can we, at least for me it is. I don't know whether you guys are getting warm. Maybe can we open the door? And if it gets cold for people sitting by the door. Okay, so I need to tell you what to do with color and flavor indices. Alpha and beta are color indices running from 1 to 3. A and B are flavor indices running from 1 to 3. And this is going to be proportional to the gap delta. And what I want to do is I want to figure out what to do with all those indices. And I said I want to antisymmetrize in color. So the way I antisymmetrize in color is with an epsilon tensor, but I'm in SU3 color, so it needs a third index, which we have to decide what to do with in a minute. I want to antisymmetrize in flavor. Same story, two indices soaked up, and a third one not yet used. Now, suppose I stuck here 1, 1. If I did, or 1, 2 for that matter. Suppose I picked numbers to go in those blanks. Then if I pick the number 1 here, that means only colors 2 and 3 are pairing. And if I pick the number 1 here, then only flavors 2 and 3 are pairing. So you don't use all the quarks. It turns out that the most attractive channel the one which allows all the quarks to pair is one where you sum over that index. So it's 1, 1 plus 2, 2 plus 3, 3 in that last index. You can argue for this in many ways, but the physics of why this is good is that it allows all 9 quarks to pair. And it leaves a large unbroken symmetry group. And many people now have done many calculations of both the flavors I described, using diagrammatic methods, some using Polchinski's renormalization group methods, and everybody agrees that this is the channel which maximizes the condensation energy. So what are its properties? Well, if you just look at it in color alone, it has to be breaking. So where am I going to write symmetries? I want to stay in the center. So if you just look at the color symmetry of this, it's certainly breaking SU3 color. 2 quarks can't be a color singlet. And just as 2 quarks can't be an SU3 color singlet, it's breaking SU3 left flavor also. But if you just look at that, and if you ignore the difference between Greek and Latin, you can see that it's invariant under simultaneous rotations of color and flavor. Okay? If I make a simultaneous color and flavor rotation, this object is invariant. So what that means is that there's an unbroken symmetry which corresponds to simultaneous rotations of color and left flavor. Now, I do the same thing for the right-handed quarks. They also pair. And they pair in the same way. I won't rewrite the indices. And so this condensate breaks SU3 color across SU3 right flavor down to SU3 color plus right. And if I therefore look at the entire symmetry of QCD, well, not quite the entire symmetry. If I look at these symmetry groups, that's the symmetry breaking pattern. And so you see what happens is that this condensate has locked these two symmetries together. And this condensate has locked these two symmetries together. This idea of a condensate locking two symmetries should be familiar to both particle physicists and condensed matter physicists. In particle physics, the ordinary chiral condensate is a Q bar left, Q right, that leaves unbroken a symmetry when you make simultaneous right and left rotations, but breaks the relative rotation. And in condensed matter physics, if you think of the B phase in helium-3, you break an SO3 orbital cross SO3 spin down to a simultaneous SO3J. So for those of you who are familiar with helium, this is like the B phase. Okay, but just to describe it in words, we've broken chiral symmetry by a new mechanism. There's no, at this point, there's no Q bar Q condensate. We only have this and this, and yet chiral symmetry is broken. The reason for that is, suppose I try and rotate the right-handed the flavor of the right-handed quarks. This condensate objects and says that wasn't a symmetry. But I can make this condensate happy by rotating color in such a way as to compensate the bad effects of my first rotation. So now this guy's happy, but this condensate now says, no, that's not a symmetry because you rotated color. So to make this one happy, I have to rotate left flavor. And the result is that chiral symmetry is broken. The only symmetry that's left unbroken is one involving simultaneous left and right rotations. So if we count Goldstone bosons, there are 16 at this point Goldstone bosons. 8 of them get eaten by the Anderson-Higgs mechanism. And so you get 8 massive vector bosons, massive spin 1 particles. 8 of them are Goldstone bosons. And these 8 Goldstone bosons are massless until you include the effects of small quark masses. And once you include quark masses, these will get small masses, just like in the vacuum. The formulae are different. The effective theory for these Goldstone bosons has been worked on at great length. Thomas Schaefer is one of the experts. I'm not going to present it. Okay, there's one more symmetry which I didn't talk about yet, which is the U1 of baryon number. That's broken, so there's no remnant over here. In other words, this stuff is a superfluid. So if we think about what this stuff, what the properties are of this stuff. Well, it has some light excitations corresponding to chiral symmetry breaking. It has a superfluid mode. And now I want to think about electromagnetism, which I haven't mentioned yet. I want to ask, in terms of ordinary electromagnetism, is this thing a superconductor or not? So we have to find electromagnetism. If you remember, electromagnetism is a U1 symmetry, which is generated by a charge Q. And this charge Q is 2/3 for up quarks, minus 1/3 for down quarks, and minus 1/3 for strange quarks. And that means the fact that those add up to zero means that this abelian generator, is actually an abelian subgroup of the SU3 flavor symmetry. It's a subgroup of this. So electromagnetism lives in here. Electromagnetism is a subgroup of this cross this. So I want to now ask, what are the gauge symmetries on the left-hand side? Well, all of these are gauged, and one subgroup of these are gauged. And then what happened over here is that the symmetry obtained by simultaneous rotations of this and this was left unbroken. And so what that means is that there must be a U1 in here, which is gauged. So there must be a new U1, which is generated by a new charge, which I'm going to call Q tilde. And it turns out that Q tilde is equal to QEM plus the generator of one of the color symmetries, which I'm going to normalize unconventionally. And check my signs. It's minus 2/3 if you're red. It's plus 1/3 if you're green. Actually, just so I don't confuse myself, minus 2/3 if you're blue, plus 1/3 if you're red, and plus 1/3 if you're green. And so this is a new charge. If I want to know what is the charge of a red up quark has a charge which is 2/3 for its upness, 1/3 for its redness. So a red up quark has Q tilde equals plus 1. And a blue down quark, blue down is minus 1. And now if you go back and check this condensate, by my conventions here, red, green, blue is 1, 2, 3. Up, down, strange is 1, 2, 3. And I've carefully constructed this charge such that if you look in here, you will find, yes, a red up quark. Actually, if you put a 3 here, if you make A be 3, then this is 1 and this is 2. I've done it 1, 2, 3. So anyway, this is 2 and this is 1, this is 1 and this is 2. And when capital A is 3, you find that this pairing occurs. So what you find is that an RUBD pair has Q tilde equals 0. And you can play this game with all of the pairs that occur in this pattern. And this is not something that's best done at the chalkboard. But you can play this game with all the pairs that occur in this pattern, and you'll find that every pair in here has Q tilde equals 0. So in other words, this condensate, I'm going to erase this. This condensate leaves this U1 unbroken. So this U1 is unbroken. And anytime you have an unbroken charge, it means you have a photon. A symmetry associated with an unbroken gauge charge, you have a photon. So there's a new photon, which is a linear combination of the old photon plus a gluon. So this linear combination is a photon whose electric and magnetic fields satisfy Maxwell's equations. The orthogonal combination, which I'll call A mu x, we really should have called it A mu z, but anyway, we made a mistake. We called it A mu x. That's minus sine theta A mu plus cos theta G mu. And that one is Higgs. This guy is Higgs. And what is this, this mixing angle? It's the analog of the Weinberg angle. So in other words, if you just look at gauge symmetries, so if you do gauge symmetries alone, the symmetry breaking pattern here is U1 electromagnetism cross SU3 color goes to U1 Q tilde. And that should look a lot like electroweak breaking. You've broken this gauge symmetry down to this one, where U1 Q tilde is a linear combination of this and one of these. And this is the analog of the photon. This is the analog of the Z boson. And cos theta is the Weinberg angle. I'm sorry, theta is the Weinberg angle. And it turns out that sine theta is approximately E over G. The exact expression doesn't matter. But it's small. OK, so this means that this condensate is neutral with respect to this photon. So you can now ask, becomes a sensible question to ask, what does this stuff look like? We have a photon. Does it propagate? In particular, is this material a conductor? I mean, this is an unbroken gauge symmetry, but we don't know yet whether the material is a conductor or an insulator. And the answer turns out to be that it's an insulator. And the reason is you start enumerating all the possible charge excitations, where charge means charge with respect to this new U1 Q tilde. You go through the list, and you find that they all have either a gap in the case of fermions or a mass in the case of bosons. You might worry about the Goldstone boson. Some of them are charged, but they all get masses.
Christian?
Yes?
Could you just say a word about, so you identify this U1 in the preserved group as being gauged. You've got 7 other generators. Do you identify them as global in that sense?
No, from here?
You have the preserved SU3
right.
L plus R plus. So everything that's not U1
is,
U tilde
is global. Right. So in fact, when you classify excitations in this theory, they fall into multiplets of SU3. It's just like classifying excitations of the vacuum. They fall into multiplets of isospin, and they have an electric charge. It's the same thing here. Every excitation, you can say what multiplet of SU3 it falls in and what its charge is. And in fact, it looks uncannily like the vacuum, which is not a point I was going to stress, but it's true. OK, so if you ask what can a Q tilde photon scatter off of, the answer is at low enough temperatures, at temperatures smaller than the mass of the lightest Q tilde charged excitation, this material is a transparent insulator.
But you were just telling us there are charged Goldstone bosons.
Right. And you give them a mass by turning on quark masses. So I've now turned on small but non-zero masses for the up, down, and strange quarks. And we'll discuss the effects of mass differences in a minute. For the moment, you can just imagine that I've turned on equal masses for up, down, and strange to lift those Goldstone boson masses so that I can make the statement that this is a transparent insulator.
Is niobium an insulator or a superconductor?
This niobium?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Low nickel, then.
It's a superconductor. I mean, I guess I don't know niobium. Lead is a superconductor. And the point is that this material, there are, if you want to ask, is it a superconductor or an insulator, you get to ask that 9 times, because there are 9 different gauge symmetries. And for 8 of them, it's a superconductor. So that's why it's good to call the color superconductor. But for one of them, it's an insulator. And the point is that the Cooper pairs in niobium have charge minus 2. So it's EE. So they have charge minus 2. They break U1 electromagnetism. There's no more gauge symmetries to talk about. Here, we have 9 gauge symmetries, 8 from color, 1 from electromagnetism. The Cooper pairs are charged with respect to 8 of them, 7 out of here plus this combination. And they're neutral with respect to the 9th combination, namely this one. So with respect to this photon, this stuff is an insulator. So if you want to think about this stuff, it's fortuitous that we called it a color superconductor, because it's not really a superconductor with respect to electromagnetism. Because you can see, by the way, that sine theta is pretty close to 0. And so the funny photon is mostly real photon. So with respect to this, which is pretty close to this, the thing is not a superconductor at all. But it's an insulator. because there are no light charged excitations because you've gapped the whole Fermi surface. Okay, now before I complicate the story, which I'm going to, let me ask what we can tell astrophysicists about this stuff. Suppose that I have a star which, you know, the simplest possibility, I should say that we know that the this color flavor locked phase, that's its name, is the right answer at large enough mu. The simplest possible story for this phase diagram is just hadron gas and then CFL. We're going to discuss complications in a minute, but if this was the phase diagram, then what would a star look like? Well, a star would either look like just this, if the centers of neutron stars only go up to there, then you just have an ordinary neutron star, or they would look like this with a CFL core. And I want to ask, what are the properties of one of these things? Can we tell the astrophysicists something which will allow them to come back and tell us the objects we observe are these and not these, or these and not these? It turns out to be quite difficult. What can we tell them? Well, first of all, we have to ask whether in a star we're at a temperature below TC. And the answer is yes, because the temperature of stars is of order keV, or hundreds of 100 keV at most. So, except in the first few seconds. So long as we're not talking about the first few seconds after a supernova, stars are cold compared to TC. And their cores, if they are made of quark matter, those quarks are paired. So then you can ask, well, what's the difference between this star and this? It turns out that the radius is decreased by a few kilometers, say a kilometer or two. But that's not an interesting statement, because the uncertainty in the radius is still dominated by all the things we don't know about nuclear matter. Basically, the uncertainty in the radius is dominated by the uncertainty of the physics of this stuff out here.
That would be true even for a quark matter phase that has no quasi particles.
Yeah, but I'm just enumerating. There is an interesting possibility, there is an interesting qualitative difference here, which is that there's a big density step right here. And if I plot, say, density as a function of radius, then a star like this looks like that. And that density step is actually of order a factor of 2. It's not a small effect. This raises the possibility, although no one has done a real calculation, of a LIGO signature, in the sense that when you collide two such stars, and an ordinary LIGO signature is two neutron stars, two of these guys in spiraling and merging. And most of the analyses of that assume that neutron stars are one length scale objects. The only length scale in the problem is the radius. This is a two length scale object. It has a core radius where most of the matter is. Basically, the mass is controlled by this, but the radius is controlled by the outer stuff. So there's two radii in the problem now. No one has done this calculation yet, so we don't know. If you do order of magnitude estimates, the frequencies seem a little bit high. So this is going to be a tough game. LIGO is, its sweet spot is around 1,000 hertz. If you just play order of magnitude games, you get 2 or 3,000 hertz. But no one has done the calculation for real yet.
Excuse me, why do you say the mass is controlled by the quark phase?
Well, if you just look at one of these and ask how much of the mass is in the interior, it turns out to be a large fraction.
So that means that the jump is actually very far out because the stuff out there is weighted with R squared.
Yeah, but it's, yeah. So I can put, well, I can make it, I mean, there are big uncertainties in this having to do with where you put the boundary. But I can make a star where half the mass is in here and half the mass is out here. So I just shouldn't say controlled by. The core makes a significant contribution to the mass. Okay, it turns out, by the way, as just an advertisement, this boundary layer, this is not of astrophysical interest, but the physics of this boundary layer itself is quite interesting. There are charged boundary layers. It's like an inversion layer at the boundary between two different semiconductors. Between a semiconductor and an insulator. But that's not where I want to go. Okay, so the fact that this is a transparent insulator, what does that mean for an astrophysicist? Well, the fact that it's an insulator, the fact that it's transparent, that's not so useful because you can't actually see it. It's cloaked in nuclear matter. If it were bare, if you had a bare quark star, you could actually imagine shining light off of it and measuring reflection and refraction. But although that's fun, and in fact the calculation's been done, for a quark matter core, you can't literally see it. But you can ask how it responds to magnetic fields. A static magnetic field, a large static magnetic field, as all real neutron stars are thought to possess. And the answer is it doesn't do much of anything, because the magnetic field is not in, will not be in flux tubes. It's not frozen. So if these outer layers are supporting some large magnetic field, this inner core won't do anything interesting to it. It's an insulator. So in terms of the dynamics of magnetic fields over the history of a neutron star, this core does very little. Now, what about cooling? Another observable which people care about is how fast do these stars cool. And so long as we're talking about temperatures less than the Goldstone boson mass, and just to be safe, I'm going to put 5 MeV here. These Goldstone bosons typically have masses of order 10 MeV. Then then we know what happens. This is due to work of some people in the room, including Thomas. And some people who were here for the program earlier. These objects, this core of these objects have very small specific heat. They have a small specific heat because all the modes are gapped. They have small neutrino emission. The way that these neutron stars cool is that they cool by emitting neutrinos, and neutrino emission from these objects is small. And the third one is that they have very small neutrino scattering rates. The opacity to neutrinos is small. They're transparent to neutrinos also. All of these just come from the fact that all the quarks are gapped. And finally, the heat conductivity is very large. It's a superfluid. All superfluids have good conductivity. So if you ask how does this object here cool, this thing in the middle is basically inert again. It's not emitting any neutrinos. It's not scattering any neutrinos. It doesn't carry much specific heat. And so the cooling is dominated by the outer layers. So the cooling of this object will be very similar to the cooling of this object. Sticking this quark matter in the core, there was a previous lore that if you have a quark matter core, it radiates neutrinos like crazy and cools the star very quickly. Well, that's not true.
Actually, it will be slower because the core doesn't contribute, right?
Yeah, it will be a little bit slower, but these things, it's only exponential changes that matter in this game. So, and anyway, actually, the specific heat, the heat capacity, you've reduced the heat capacity and the neutrino emission, so it actually cools almost exactly the same. Mm-hmm. Okay, but there's the interesting frontier. So there are two interesting frontiers here.
One question?
Yeah.
You said large heat conductivity. Is that, from the second sound mode and the normal component?
Yeah.
The temperature is much, much less than TC. Is there normal fluidity, or is that a problem?
The way the calculation was done was in particle physics language, so I have to think about how to translate it. But this was done by Shafkovi, who was here, and he described it as due to the Goldstone boson associated with breaking U1, the U1 of, superfluidity, you can think of as breaking a global U1. It gives you a Goldstone boson. It's that Goldstone boson, which I guess is, second sound is a linear combination of that one and something else, right? I have to remember what second sound is now.
Density and entropy.
Yeah. Anyway, we should sort out language later, but he did a calculation. The point is the main thing is that it has small heat capacity and doesn't emit neutrinos. So suppose it had zero heat conductivity, then it would stay warm, but it wouldn't carry much heat. Instead, what happens is that it cools by conductivity to the outside.
What about rotation?
Yeah. So it's a superfluid. So So that means it has rotational vortices. So if you rotate this object, it'll have vortices. And I want to come back to that. Geez, I'm way over time. I want to come back to that in a second. Okay, before we talk about superfluid vortices, let me just say that there is an interesting frontier, which is what happens if you consider temperatures bigger than 5 MeV. In other words, supernovae. Here, I think there is really interesting physics, which is as yet not completely well calculated. Greg Carter has started on this. And the point here is that now a lot of these statements become more complicated because of the Goldstone bosons. There are neutrino emission processes. There is significant scattering. The heat capacity is not negligible anymore, and there are various phase transitions. In particular, you can think of a supernova in which supernovas start out pretty hot, and then you cool into this, and you can ask about this phase transition. And this is something which various people have been thinking about, and I think it's an interesting frontier. Okay, but what I want to do now...
If you're about to leave neutron stars, can I ask, what reason is there to believe that a CFL core will form even if it's the favored equilibrium state? Doesn't this require nucleating across first order transitions?
No, you'll be cooling from up here.
Yeah, but what sort of transition is that? Don't I still have to nucleate something?
It depends. The order of this transition is not really known, I would say. But if it's, first of all, you have a lot of time. You've got the whole age of, so long as it happens, this is not something that has to happen quickly. Right here, I was talking about neutron stars that are years or hundreds of thousands of years old. So I don't think I need to worry about it being stuck in a metastable form of quark matter.
But you can also do it from the left.
You can also do it from the left. No one has calculated these nucleation rates, so I suppose you could worry, but I'm not worried.
The envelope estimates, which span more than enough decades in the exponent.
Well, these are pretty dirty environments. I mean, all you need is a defect, and if you're talking about a hot supernova cooling down, there are lots of defects in the form of, bumps on the edges and who knows what. I'm not worried.
Say a word about the qualitative picture, what conceivably would give this LIGO signature. Obviously,
oh.
You're not thinking of something totally isotropic. Because
No. The LIGO signature here is two neutron stars in spiraling. Mm-hmm. And roughly speaking, Scott can correct my roughly speaking, but roughly speaking, what happens in one of those events is for a long, long time, it's basically two-point masses in spiraling, and you get some regular so-called chirp in the gravitational wave signal. And then at some point, all hell breaks loose. And all hell breaks loose when you get these two objects close enough to each other, they start to tidally deform each other. So I have two objects, they start to deform. And what will happen with one of these is that, first of all, half of all hell will break loose, and only a little later, all hell will break loose. And the question is whether you can see in the signature the difference between all hell breaking loose versus all hell breaking loose in two stages. That's the question, and it's not... The real calculation has not been done. Okay, so I now need to complicate the story because I have not been taking seriously the effects of the strange quark difference, the difference between the strange quark mass and the up and down quark masses. And so I need to take into account the fact that the strange quark mass is much bigger than the light quark masses. And it turns out, as I'll pseudo-explain in a minute, that CFL occurs whenever mu is bigger than ms squared over 4 delta. And first of all, I should say that in the real world, once you include strange quark masses, those two condensates that I described can rotate one relative to the other. This is called a K0 condensation, and Thomas has worked on that. It doesn't change the qualitative features that I described, so I won't say more. But you can ask, when does this pairing simply go away? When do you spoil it by turning on a large quark mass difference? The answer is the pairing persists when mu is bigger than ms squared over 4 delta. But this is actually quite an uncertain criterion to use, because this, I said, is safe. This is 20 to 200. This MS is actually a density. This is, well, it's a quasi-particle mass, if you like. It's a constituent quark mass. So we don't actually know whether the phase diagram looks like this, with CFL all the way down to where hadrons occur, or whether there is some line here, which I'm only indicating topologically, it won't actually be vertical, some line here where mu is bigger than ms squared over 4 delta on this side, and mu is less than ms squared over 4 delta on this side. And I want to say a few words about what happens in quark matter here if there is a regime of quark matter where mu is small. And the reason why this is interesting is that here you have, well, this is qualitatively different because here you have to take into account the strange quark mass. And you can think of this by thinking about non-interacting quark matter. So just for orientation, if you think about non-interacting quark matter and ask how do Fermi momenta evolve with MS, if I turn on a strange quark mass and maintain electric neutrality and weak equilibrium, then, well, I'm not going to draw this so well. Those are supposed to be split by equal amounts, so that didn't work very well. That's a bit better. This is up, down, and strange quarks, and you now are also introducing electrons into the problem. And this, delta PF, this splitting between Fermi momenta is of order ms squared over 4 mu. So what's happening in normal quark matter, no pairing, when you turn on a strange quark mass, is you're pushing Fermi surfaces apart. And CFL pairing fights against this, because in CFL pairing, you pair quarks with all flavors with each other, and you do so by forcing the Fermi momenta to stay together, even though the quark mass is trying to push it apart. And so when this becomes bigger than delta, the CFL breaks. So the question of what happens in here is the question of what happens when you have pairing between fermions with different Fermi surfaces. And this is something which was analyzed a long time ago in kinetic matter physics by Larkin, Ovchinnikov, Fulda, and Farrell. And it leads to a phenomenon which in this context is called crystalline color superconductivity. Actually, this needs figures, so I'm going to switch to transparencies.
Why do the up, down, and entropy by about the same
amount? Why do they change is easy. Why do they change by the same amount? You have to do the little calculation. Why do they all change? They all change because you would say, well, first of all, let me push the strange quarks down. That makes it not electrically neutral. To maintain electric neutrality, you turn on a chemical potential for electric charge, and that splits the up and the down. So why they're equal, you have to do the calculation. Okay, so I want to show a figure, and I'm going to cheat by showing the transparency before the figure, so I don't have to write this on the board. So if I want to pair quark matter with different Fermi momenta, how do I do that? Well, the goal of the exercise here is to make pairs such that both quarks in a pair live on their respective Fermi surface. And the idea, then, is to form Cooper pairs with non-zero momentum. If I make a Cooper pair of two quarks, instead of P and minus P, it's P plus Q and minus P plus Q, then I can have both the P plus Q quark and the minus P plus Q quark be on their respective Fermi surface. But now you notice that the Cooper pair has momentum 2Q. It turns out that the physics, the energetics, determines the magnitude of 2Q. It's of order that delta PF. And the physics also determines the pattern of the set of QIs that you choose. The result is a condensate which looks like a sum of plane waves with a bunch of different QIs. The pattern of the directions of QIs is chosen, which I'll show in a second, and the magnitude is chosen, but the overall orientation is picked spontaneously. So you get spontaneous breaking of rotational and translational symmetry, and Jeff Bowers gave a talk here a few weeks ago in which he showed this figure, which is why I wanted the transparency. This is what the pattern looks like. It turns out that the favored pattern is the sum of 8 plane waves, which I've written as 4 cosines. And if you look at that with Mathematica, this is what it looks like. It has planes where the condensate vanishes. These are nodal planes. And then in each cell, the condensate is either negative or positive. If you only care about the magnitude of the condensation, this is a simple cubic structure. If you are aware of its sign, this is a face-centered cubic structure. This phenomenon was first discussed by Larkinoff, Chinnikov, Fulda, and Farrell, but I think that this paper which Jeff described a couple of weeks ago, is really the first effort to construct the Ginzburg-Landau theory that tells you what the favored crystal structure is in 3 dimensions. It's been done in 2 dimensions before, but never in 3, and this is it. And now I want to talk about vortices, which I was asked about. The other observable from pulsars that is worth thinking about is the fact that pulsars glitch. What is a pulsar glitch? Well, a pulsar is rotating. It's happily spinning at some frequency omega, which is slowly decreasing over a million years, and then all of a sudden it spins up by 1 part in a billion to 1 part in a million. The conventional understanding of what this spin up, this sudden spin up, has to do with is the pinning of rotational vortices in the crust of an ordinary neutron star. And there are many the details of different mechanisms differ, but everyone who discusses pulsar glitches agrees that it has something to do with the fact that these rotational vortices, as the star spins down, they're trying to move apart, and yet they can't. They're sort of stuck in the crust. And this then raises the obvious possibility that the crust is not the only place where glitches may occur. So if the phase diagram of QCD has a region of crystalline phase, then a neutron star would look like this instead of like what I had before. You'd have a layer in which it's crystalline and only CFL only in the very middle. And that then raises the possibility that rotational vortices can get stuck, pinned in here. And this is ongoing research because it's not at all obvious actually how to construct a vortex in a crystalline phase. If you take the condensate that I just showed and try and think about rotating it, you get confused, which is where we are right now. So I think the frontier, there are several frontiers here. One is, if you have a star which is just CFL in the middle, then you're forced to think about very dynamical processes like supernovae and neutron star collisions, because this CFL stuff is quite inert. So if you want to have astrophysical signatures from a star which is just has a CFL core, it's hard except in very dynamical circumstances, as I said, like the supernova itself or like a LIGO event. On the other hand, this red stuff, first of all, no one has yet done the neutrino emission calculation for this, but it will be significant. So people, all of the things that I said were inert before are no longer inert. No one has done the magnetic field response of this stuff. It will be interesting. Because there are gapless quasi-particles living on the nodes. The gap goes to zero along those nodal planes. And so there'll be neutrino emission from the quarks living at the nodes. No one's done the calculation, so we don't know how significant, but it's not inert anymore. And it's also not inert with respect to magnetic fields. It's not inert with respect to rotational vortices. It's all of a sudden, instead of being inert, it can do things like pin vortices. And this is what a lot of people are thinking about right now, is what are the properties of this stuff. And as I said at the bottom here, serious glitch phenomenology awaits the calculation of the pinning force. The main thing we QCD theorists need to calculate is what happens to a rotational vortex, how strongly is it pinned. If we can do that, then we can phone up Lars's astrophysics friends and discuss glitch phenomenology. Okay, so I've totally misestimated the time of what I wanted to do. What I wanted to do now was talk about hot quark matter, what's known theoretically, and what we're learning from the experiments, but I'm not going to. Maybe David will ask me to do so on another Monday. I don't know. I'm happy to do so for anyone who's interested in listening at any time, but I better stop now. So that was half of the talk, by the way. That was actually two-thirds, yes. Yeah.
I would like to talk next time.
Sure. Be happy to. So I'll finish it next Monday. And next Monday will be the third of the talk, so it will be shorter than this. And we'll talk about heavy ion collisions and what they're teaching us. But yes?
I have a hard time visualizing how does these planes pin these...
Yes. Well, so do we. I'll tell you the idea and then why it's wrong, okay? The idea that we have is that vortices like to live... what's a vortex? It's a place where the condensate vanishes. So vortices should like to live where the... Right, but the condensate is vanishing even more along the intersection of a plane. So the naive idea is that the vortices should like to follow the intersections of planes. That's the naive idea.
Pretty
feebly pinned. Right, but it turns out that the pinning forces you need to get interesting are small compared to QCD scales anyway. That's the naive idea. Now, why is that very naive? The reason it's very naive is that we have a much earlier problem, which is how do you describe a vortex when you have this stuff, put it in a beaker and rotate it. The way you do this description, the way you do this analysis with helium-4 is you say the following. I have a superfluid, put it in a beaker, rotate it. At some point I get vortices. What does that mean? If I impose a boundary condition such that as you go around at infinity, the phase of the condensate winds once by 2 pi, then the condensate is everywhere continuous. Its magnitude is everywhere 1. But now you've said its phase winds by 2 pi. That means somewhere inside your big loop, there must be a place where the condensate vanishes. That's the vortex. Now, here, the condensate at infinity is going from plus 1 to 0 to minus 1 to 0 to plus 1 to 0, okay, already. So what happens when you rotate this? And then you get started asking an even simpler question. How do you make a current flow through here? Currents are associated in the current carried by a superfluid. If I write what I'm calling delta of x, which you might call phi of x, as rho e to the I theta, then a current goes like, well, it's let me call this phi. It goes like phi star d mu phi minus complex conjugate. And so that goes like rho squared gradient of theta. Okay? Familiar? Well, so now I want to make a current flow through here. At these nodal planes, rho is 0. So how can I make, before we even talk about a vortex, how can I make a uniform current flow through this superfluid? It's a superfluid in the sense that it breaks U on a Vera number, but it does so in a completely, for me anyway, confusing way. We actually think we have an answer to how you can make a current flow, but not for how to construct a vortex yet. The idea of how to make a current flow is, if you write phi of x, let's just look in one dimension, as cosine x, okay? So I'm only looking in one dimension. So this has nodal planes, again. Phi squared, the magnitude of phi goes to 0 along planes. And I can write that as e to the I cos kx, e to the I kx plus e to the minus I kx. If you stick a 1 plus epsilon here, so you make the coefficient of this exponential a little bigger than the coefficient of that one, you get a solution in which there's a current flowing in the x direction. Current conservation is respected. And what happens is that these nodal planes are minima but not zeros. So what's happened is that by driving a current through, you've made all the nodal planes not quite nodal planes anymore. They're minima of the condensate but not zeros. Now, we don't know yet what the vortex is going to look like. We don't know yet whether it will or will not be pinned. And that's what we're working on. Yeah.
But it's changed sign as you go through the plane. So how can it just be a minimum and zero?
You use the complex plane. What happens is that if...
Okay, so the magnitude never gets to zero.
Right.
Phase sweeps
are right. So what happens is if this is the phi plane, what a cosine is that as a function of position, you're going back and forth like this. Okay, so that's what's drawn on in three dimensions for a sum of 4 cosines on the transparency. So as you go back and forth, the condensate changes from plus to minus to plus to minus to plus to minus. Putting in a small epsilon here corresponds to something which does this. It goes around an ellipse with width epsilon, and length 1 in one of the appropriate units. And now you see there is a current because I'm following a trajectory in the complex plane here which has some area, and the current is proportional to the area. And I miss the origin. But there is still a sense in which I'm going from plus to minus to plus to minus. So that's the way to make a current flow. But, well, I leave it as a homework exercise to make a vortex. And then to calculate the pinning force. That's a homework exercise which J.D. Kundu, one of my students who was here until last week, has gone back home to solve. So.
Okay, thank you.